down the street without a word, and without a word the prince followed him. He lived in the lowest room of a thin tower, and he had few belongings, a lamp, a pallet, and a little wooden chest. The chest caught the prince's eye at once, for it was intricately carved and would have needed sharper tools than stone. A few pine branches burned on the hearth. "You said you waited for me," the prince said. "Yet how could you know me?" "You are of no importance except that you are royal-born. This I could see, having a gift for such things. One who is royal-born was expected." "Why? And for what?" "To enter the place you saw and to go into what lies beyond the briars." "What then lies there?" "Ah," the oldest one smiled, and his wrinkled skin moved on his face like sea waves. "I know only what was said, this being what my father told me. And if you would care to listen, I'll tell as much. Well, then, I was born at sunset on a strange day. It was the day the curse fell upon the valley. The nature of the curse is vague. It had to do with the 13th lady, the dark sorceress, and with a needle. For some 16 years before my birth, the king had allowed no sharp object into the valley, not an axe or a knife, not even a pin. And he had made a great bonfire and burned every spinning wheel in his kingdom on it, after which anyone who defied the law was put to death. I know nothing of the curse beyond this, except that on the day of my birth, at the very same moment that I arrived in the world, the curse came about, despite every precaution. Immediately a wall of thorns sprang up around the palace. My father and his neighbors saw it happen. The thorns twisted and turned and threaded together till the topmost towers of the palace could no longer be seen. No one could get in and no one out. The king sent for help. King's sons came, for it was said that only one royal-born could cleave through this thorn wall. But the thorns impaled them, and they died horribly. As you have seen, their bones hang there yet. After a few years, the people abandoned the city. It was a place full of ghosts and fear. The walls cracked and the roof fell in until it was as you find. Only my father and my mother remained, and I, their child. I have outlived them, and I have known no other life than waiting for the last royal-born. "But how can you know who will be the last?" the prince asked very low. "That was the softening of the curse. After 100 years it might be broken if there were any man here to dare it." "You stayed my hand," the prince said. "Yes, for it was not the time. When the sun sinks tonight beyond the hills, that will be at the hour of my birth and the hour of the curse. I shall be 100 years old at sunset." All through the afternoon the rain darted and rang on the stones of the city. But at last the sky cleared and turned golden, and the sun rested like a great lamp on the crown of hills. "Now it is the time," said the oldest one, and the prince rose. It was very chill, and his arms burned coldly where the dark woman had touched it. "What shall I find?" he asked as he stood in the doorway. "Suppose I should only turn away and leave the valley by the quickest route?" "You know you can never do that till you've seen. As to what you will find, they say something beautiful lies asleep there, but it was seldom spoken of. I scarcely know." It was very silent when he walked back up the slanting street. He paused at the rusty gate, and the bones rattled on the briars. He drew his knife as before and took a step inside. The great thorn stems writhed and twisted, though there was then no wind, and the barbs clashed together with the sound of battle. He raised his blade and struck at them. He'd come to expect by that time almost anything, and so was not surprised. The thorn wall broke apart before him and curled aside, forming a long avenue stretching away and away into the dim, gloomy distance. He hesitated a moment. If he went up the path offered, the wall might easily spring back about him, and he would suffer the fate of all the rest. But something seemed to pull him on. He could no longer hang back. The shadow of the thorns fell over him, but the avenue did not close up, though the stems thrashed about like angry serpents on either side. Underfoot the soil was gray. The thorns had drained it. For a long time there was only the moving latticed shadows in the gray soil. Then a pale light glowed in front of him. It was the end of the briar tunnel. He ran toward it and suddenly came into the lavender gloaming. Immediately, with a terrible sound, the thorns closed rank behind him. There was no room left in him for alarm. But he was on a marble terrace which rose in marble steps to an incredible garden above. Dark green trees had been pruned into the shapes of birds and animals. Fountains jetted into porphyry basins, and 1,000 roses bloomed. Not a leaf moved. The flowers were like things made of wax, and the water of the fountain stayed quite still like threads of crystal suspended in midair. The prince climbed the steps and stood in the garden, mystified and troubled, and ahead rose the vast pile of a palace with pointing milk-white towers. Taking one deep breath, he began to walk towards it. On the trees birds sat, their beaks open in silent song. He came upon a garland of doves with spread wings simply hanging impossibly in the air, and on the lawn a springing cat with its paws several inches from the ground, quite motionless. The doors of the palace were open as if something had rushed through them and blown them wide. Inside, soldiers with glaring eyes stood to attention down the length of the great hall. Pages were transfixed in the act of moving with their trays of sweets, and graceful women and proud men were posed in all manner of gestures, some laughing with their heads thrown back, the dim light glinting on their teeth, others frowning or yawning as they must have done for 100 years. The prince noted that these people had kept their velvets and silks, although there were no hairpins or brooches, and the soldiers carried stone clubs at their belts. He came to 2 thrones of gold, and here sat a king and a queen. Her face was sad and pale, his harsh and cruel. It seems they had guessed at the last instant that the curse had fallen after all. Huge nets of cobwebs drifted over everything, caught between the golden chandeliers, the lion feet of the chair, the fingers of the king. They alone moved. As an enamel clock stood in the corner, but its hands had fallen off and lay on the floor, for this place, in this place, time had stopped. The prince went from room to room, seeking something out, he did not know what. On the marble staircase a servant was lighting lamps, and the flare of his taper stood up like a piece of yellow ice, not flickering. The prince came into the upper rooms, and here the twilight fell very thick like the dust. He came to a strange, narrow, dark door and pushed it open. There was a waiting lady here, her hands frozen at her mouth, which was open on a soundless scream, and her eyes wide in terror. He looked where she was looking, up at a twisted, ugly stair to a half-open door at the top. He ran up the steps and threw open the door. It was a long, narrow gallery, mostly pitch black, yet lit at the center by a shivering gray light. The first thing he saw there was the spinning wheel which gave off this light. It was all silver, even to the wheel, which, as he took half a step into the room, began suddenly to whirl round so fast and so angrily that hissing white sparks flew off it and burst into the air. It gave out a sawing, spitting noise, but he came on toward it, for like the thorns, it seemed to have no power to harm him. When he passed it by, he glanced down and saw that on the tip of the wicked needle rested a single ruby, 1 drop of human blood. A thick mesh of cobwebs hung behind the spinning wheel. He thrust through them and stopped dead still, for he knew he had found what he had came for. There was a great carved bed hung with black velvet. On the curtains was embroidered many times the symbol of the silver wheel the sorceress had worn on her hand, and at the front of the canopy was a silver shield. Written on this shield in scarlet letters were the words, "My final gift to her, her deathbed." His heart thudded in slow, heavy hammer strokes. The prince walked up to the bed and looked down at what lay there. She was more beautiful than anything he had ever seen. She wore white silk with diamonds at her throat, but she shone more brightly. Her hands were like white feathers on the black velvet bed, her skin like lampshine through alabaster, but her hair was light itself. The prince stared at her and did not know what he must do, for she was quite still and unmoving, and more marvelous than any of the wonders he had ever seen. She did not even breathe. Then it came to him, that miracle in an eastern city, when he had seen a man brought back to life. It seemed quite wrong that he should even touch her, she looked so peaceful. Yet it seemed also important that he had remembered at this moment how the thing was done. So he set his feelings aside and leaned down and placed his mouth on hers and blew into her lungs the breath of life as he had seen the priest do it. At first her ribcage rose and fell only with his breath, but presently she gave a deep sigh and he let her go. Her eyelids fluttered and lifted, and she looked at him and smiled. "Welcome, royal-born," she said. "So you came as they said you would." At that the whirling thing shot off from the body of the spinning wheel and cracked into 1,000 pieces like glass. It was strange. He had never really been afraid until she woke and looked at him. Then fear began. She led him down the hall where now all the lamps flickered gold. The people moved rustily and stared about like ghosts. They were so old, and yet they had hardly lived at all. The king and queen drew her into their embraces, moving like puppets, and then there was a feast. They sat at the long tables among the drifting cobwebs and ate the roast meats and the peaches that had kept perfect for 100 years, and they spoke in slow, hollow voices of all the things that had been 100 years before and were no longer, though they did not know. It filled the prince with a terrible, icy melancholy. Even she, his princess sitting at his side, seemed to be looking up at him out of her beautiful eyes through the dull waters of an ocean, the century which was between them. Near dawn, when the sad, weird figures still moved in their old forgotten dances in the hall, he drew her out into the garden. Beyond the animal trees and the fountains, he saw that all the thorns had withered and fallen into dust, which now blew about the hill. For a long while, the palace of the king would be surrounded by a desert of black dunes. He took her hand, which felt unreal, like the hand of a doll, and said, "Madam, I can't stay with you." "This I know," she said. "I saw it in your face at once." She didn't weep or frown, but she murmured, "After all, I am still asleep. I shall never be awake again." He tried to comfort her, but it was no use, and he saw it, and her pride. So he kissed her gently and went away as the sun was rising. He didn't look for the oldest man in the city. He looked neither left nor right till he was out of the valley, and then he did not look back. On the road, the black stone was still standing up, and there was a raven perched on it which stared at him with silver eyes. "So, after all, you had the last laugh, 13th lady," he said to it. "You are more clever than you thought." But the bird flew up into the wide, clear sky without a sound. That was Thorns from Tanith Lee's collection, Red as Blood. The subtitle, or Tales from the Sisters, Grimmer. Pretty grim story, eh? Next, the companion piece from Don't Bet on the Prince, edited by Jack Zipes. This poem is called Briar Rose. It's by Anne Sexton. Consider a girl who keeps slipping off, arms limp as old carrots, into the hypnotist's trance, into a spirit world speaking with the gift of tongues. She is stuck in the time machine, suddenly 2 years old, sucking her thumb as inward as a snail, learning to talk again. She's on a voyage. She is swimming further and further back, up like a salmon, struggling into her mother's pocketbook. "Little doll child, come here to Papa, sit on my knee. I have kisses for the back of your neck. A penny for your thoughts, princess. I will hunt them like an emerald. Come be my Snooky, and I will give you a root." That kind of voyage rank as honeysuckle. Once, a king had a christening for his daughter Briar Rose, and because he had only 12 gold plates, he asked only 12 fairies to the grand event. The 13th fairy, her fingers as long and thin as straws, her eyes burnt by cigarettes, her uterus an empty teacup, arrived with an evil gift. She made this promise, this prophecy: "The princess shall prick herself on a spinning wheel in her 15th year and then fall down dead, kaput." The court fell silent. The king looked like Munch's scream. Fairies' prophecies in those times held water. However, the 12th fairy had a certain kind of eraser, and thus she mitigated the curse, changing that death into 100 years sleep. The king ordered every spinning wheel exterminated and exorcised. Briar Rose grew to be a goddess, and each night the king bit the hem of her gown to keep her safe. He fastened the moon up with a safety pin to give her perpetual light. He forced every male in the court to scour his tongue with babbo, lest they poison the air she dwelt in. Thus she dwelt in his odor, rank as honeysuckle. On her 15th birthday, she pricked her finger on a charred spinning wheel, and the clock stopped. Yes, indeed. She went to sleep. The king and queen went to sleep. the courtiers, the flies on the walls. The fire in the hearth grew still, and the roast meat stopped crackling. The trees turned into metal, and the dog became china. They all lay in a trance, each a catatonic stuck in the time machine. Even the frogs were zombies. Only a bunch of briar roses grew, forming a great wall of tacks around the castle. Many princes tried to get through the brambles, for they had heard much of Briar Rose, but they had not scoured their tongues, so they were held by the thorns and thus were crucified. In due time, 100 years passed, and a prince got through. The briars parted as if for Moses, and the prince found the tableau intact. He kissed Briar Rose, and she woke up crying, "Daddy, Daddy!" Presto, she's out of prison. She married the prince, and all went well, except for the fear of sleep. Briar Rose was an insomniac. She could not nap or lie in sleep without the court chemist mixing her some knockout drops, and never in the prince's presence. "If it is to come," she said, "sleep must take me unawares while I am not laughing or dancing, so that I do not know that brutal place where I lie down with the cattle prods, the hole in my cheek open. Further, I must not dream, for when I do, I see the table set and a faltering crone at my place, her eyes burnt by cigarettes, and she eats betrayal like a slice of meat. I must not sleep, for while asleep I'm 90 and think I'm dying. Death rattles in my throat like a marble. I wear tubes like earrings. I lie as still as a bar of iron. You can stick a needle through my kneecap and I won't flinch. I'm all shot up with Novocaine. This trance girl is yours to do with. You could lay her in a grave, an awful package, and shovel dirt on her face, and she'd never call back, 'Hello there.' But if you kissed her on the mouth, her eyes would spring open, and she'd call out, 'Daddy, Daddy.' Presto, she's out of prison. There was a theft, that much I am told. I was abandoned, that much I know. I was forced backward. I was forced forward. I was passed hand to hand like a bowl of fruit. Each night I am nailed into place and I forget who I am. Daddy? That's another kind of prison. It's not the prince at all, but my father, drunkenly bent over my bed, circling the abyss like a shark. My father thick upon me like some sleeping jellyfish. What voyage is this, little girl? This coming out of prison? God help. This life after death.
All the good times have been had, and there's nothing more to be said. I don't like being trite, but I love you. I love you. When my evening star comes around again, you won't find me sitting where I was when you first came. When my evening star tells me it's time for a change, the words may change and a song may change. Time. Think of all love. match it with the bad time. When my evening star comes around to say, once upon you had someone set. Stand by me anyway, and I need a lover who won't want to bother with yesterday. Flame, good time, bad time. Measured with a bad time. Good times have been had, and there's nothing more to be said. I don't like being trite, but
Janice Ian, a lovely song called Evening Star from Songs for All the Seasons of Your Mind. And before that, if I did it justice, I don't read poetry very well. Briar Rose, subtitled Sleeping Beauty by Anne Sexton, written in 1971. That is from an anthology called Don't Bet on the Prince, Contemporary Feminist Fairy Tales in North America and England. Was edited by Jack Zipes, Z-I-P-E-S. And before that, Thorns, Tanith Lee's version of Sleeping Beauty, where things do not exactly end up happily ever after. A curse is a curse is a curse. That is from Red as Blood, or Tales from the Sisters Grimmer, by Tanith Lee, and that was published by DAW, D-A-W, stands for Donald A. Walheim, and I only know that because of Jim Freund, who has a show here on Saturday mornings, 5 to 7 a.m., called Hour of the Wolf, and it is a great show. So if you're up, and I don't know that by next Saturday morning, it might still be 122 degrees outside, so you might indeed still be up from now till then, but give his show a listen. It's really good, and he promotes my show, I promote his show, so it's okay. My name is Sharon Griffiths. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. The name of the show is Heresy, and I will be back the second week in August with more feminist fairy tales and such. Please write to me if you will be so kind, if you would be so kind. The address here is 505 8th Avenue, New York, 10018, and you can just address it to Heresy or to Sharon, S-H-A-R-O-N, Griffiths, G-R-I-F-F-I-T-H-S. And now at 6:57, almost 6:58 in the morning, I will say goodbye, wish you good luck in handling the heat, and remember, don't snap at your partner, your life partner, your mate, your boss, the people who work for you. Don't just be calm. It's got to end sometime. And I will speak to you when I get back on the air in 2 weeks. Thanks so much.
Smith can be heard on alternate Sunday nights, Monday mornings from 1 a.m. to 3 a.m. Tune in.
You've got your dial set to 99.5 FM WBAI in New York City. The time is 7 a.m. It's time for Through the Opera Glass, a weekly feature of this station. Today's host is Manya, and this program has been pre-recorded for broadcast at this time. And now, Through the Opera Glass.
Welcome to Through the Opera Glass. I'm Manya, and on this program we are going to explore famous pairs or couples. I think we'll start with one of my favorites, which most likely is one of yours.
Welche Freude wird uns sein,
wenn die Götter uns belegen?